A lifetime of training, practice, study, hard work. Through discipline, some achieve excellence, mastery, fulfillment, self-actualization. What can we learn from their beginnings, discoveries, motivations, and falls? How do they dust themselves off and resume their journey? During these interviews, stories, and conversations, we reveal their intrinsic drive. As a young girl growing up in Australia, Eve Picker loved playing with Lego blocks, solving math problems, and exploring cities. Armed with degrees in architecture and urban design, she moved to Pittsburgh's Friendship neighborhood, where she renovated an old Victorian home with her husband. Eve found her tribe by joining a protesting community which united to save a nearby historic home from demolition. Her community of volunteers formed a nonprofit, and she never looked back. She built the first residential loft downtown after a banker mistakenly mused, "Oh, honey, nobody's going to move downtown." By the mid-2000s, community banks had consolidated from 15,000 to 5,000 across the country. Small banks that would invest in the local neighborhood were dying. City revitalization grants fell under government cutbacks. The Jobs Act of 2012 was the catalyst for Eve's pivot and next big idea. The act, implemented in 2016, allowed anyone over 18 to invest in crowdfunding. Eve is the founder and CEO of Small Change, a real estate equity crowdfunding platform. She raises funds for meaningful real estate projects that make cities better. Eve's journey as an architect, city planner, urban designer, real estate developer, community development strategist, and publisher gives her unique perspective and a deep understanding how cities work, how urban neighborhoods can be revitalized, what policies need to be in place. And she employs her own marketing through her Rethink Real Estate for Good website and weekly podcast. Her City Lab Foundation has developed a dozen buildings in fractured neighborhoods and built Pittsburgh's first teeny house. This urban change agent has organized a speaker series, launched the Pop City e-zine, and created Iron City's first co-working space, an open streets program. This fintech pioneer and urban change agent's proprietary technology is ranked in the top 7 real estate crowdfunding platforms of 2020 by U.S. News, nabbing the top spot in the capital category by Hive. Eve is a fellow at the Bellagio Center residency of the Rockefeller Foundation, and we are honored to welcome this tireless advocate for socially responsible real estate funded by everyday people to this episode of Intrinsic Drive. Eve, it's such a pleasure and a privilege to have you on Intrinsic Drive. Thanks so much for taking your time to come to the show.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Let's go to your beginning, the genesis. Kind of take us into the beginning of your journey. Was it back in Australia as a young girl being such a lover of cities, or how did this all start for you?
I always say I used to love playing with Lego blocks. I don't know if I was solely focused on architecture when I was young, but I do know that I was really always interested in art, and I really liked math as well. And at some point I decided that architecture was the only place I could go to satisfy both those needs. Yeah. I mean, at the time there weren't, you know, now there's this huge array of things you can choose from. At the time in Australia, there were very clear paths that you could take. So I started studying architecture, really, really loved it. But was always more interested in cities than the buildings themselves. I was always irritated by iconic buildings. I thought that I wanted to understand how buildings became part of the fabric of a city, and I was always interested in places like that. So, you know, once I had my architecture degree, I actually applied for a Fulbright scholarship, which I got, and took myself off to do a master's in urban design at Columbia University. And that's really when my thinking about cities and the way that buildings make places and cities clarified. So that was, I think, very, very formative for me. But I was still working as an architect and an urban designer in various studios. And then I moved to Pittsburgh. And that was really, I think, the transformational part of my career, because I found myself in a vastly different city than the one I grew up in, Sydney, yes. Australia. Yes. Sydney, Australia is wealthy and a wealthy metropolis. Pittsburgh had lost more than 50% of its population and was littered with community development corporations and a lot of vacant neighborhoods. And at the same time, I was astounded at how beautiful the downtown was. And clearly, you know, there had been a lot of wealth here. I mean, it still has, the city of Pittsburgh still has more philanthropy than I think any other city per capita. And that's, you know, the steel barons. And downtown Pittsburgh is really a gem. It has amazing buildings. And it was this very weird patchwork of very well-populated neighborhoods and very empty ones. And, you know, at the same time, I wasn't loving architecture. I was finding myself, you know, doing lots of toilet and stair details.
Right.
I'm not sure where that was going to take me. It was a very, at the time, the industry was very heavily dominated by men.
Yes.
As a woman in architecture and real estate, that's always been an issue, unfortunately.
Yes.
I can't complain compared to minorities, though. Right. So, you know, something happened that really changed my path. And that was my husband and I bought a house in a neighborhood called Friendship.
Friendship.
And it was a lovely Victorian house that was pretty dilapidated. And we loved this little neighborhood. And we really didn't have a clue what we were doing. It was very inexpensive. So we bought the house. And, sometime later, I heard that a house down the street from ours was going to be torn down by the car dealership that wanted to use it as a parking lot. And I heard about a picket line that was going to go up there, like a demonstration.
Fantastic.
Happening. Yeah. So I joined. And there I found my tribe, my crowd. All of the architects who'd moved into that neighborhood because of the architecture were there, and they were all as interested as I was in saving that neighborhood.
And this is some 20 odd years ago, obviously way before the moniker of crowdfunding. These are people coming together and saying, look, this is the right thing to do.
Yeah. Right. So we actually together formed a nonprofit community development corporation. Look, all of this was new for me. I'd never heard about nonprofit community development corporations because I'm not even sure they exist in Australia. They probably do, but there's just not the same need. And, you know, our purpose was to try and do real estate in the neighborhood that really couldn't be done at a market rate. And so we had no funds. We were just a nonprofit group of volunteers. And we had a first project that we wanted to do. It was, again, a corner building in a very prominent corner in the neighborhood, a house that had burned down. And the church wanted to tear it down for a parking lot. Apparently, parking lots are the highest and best use.
Yeah. Unfortunately.
In neighborhoods that are down and out.
Right.
And we were all adamant that we would renovate it. And so I volunteered. I volunteered to redevelop that project. And that was really the turning point for me. I absolutely fell in love with the process and went on from there to lead that nonprofit, to do lots of nonprofit work, and eventually build my own small development company and do similar work with my own projects. So, you know, the place, the neighborhood, the people kind of really pushed me in a different direction.
And this was, so this was the kind of the genesis of CityLab, organization, so, or was that was another iteration that came later from another this iteration. Initial? Okay.
So, you know, my frustration as a real estate developer was that, you know, I really didn't think I was doing anything that was rocket science, but for example, I developed the first loft in downtown Pittsburgh, literally when a banker said to me, "Oh, honey, no one's going to live downtown."
Right.
Wait, was he wrong, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, and I found myself doing these little projects in really forgotten places that were just joyful exercises for me.
Yes.
I mean, I really just wanted to do real estate that would make a difference in some way on the street level to really – I really believe that – you know, you can spend the same amount of money on redeveloping a building or developing a building and make it part of the fabric of the neighborhood and give something to the street or not. And so I was always focused on how could this building make a difference? And that was the little development company I built for myself. But what I found is when I went to these neighborhoods that no one else was in, no leasing agents would bring me tenants. Everyone thought I was nuts. It was really, these were not big projects, okay?
Right.
It was very hard to get appraisals because no one had done anything like it before. I was always battling with banks and appraisers to try and get financing. I got very familiar with little public-private financing deals because, honestly, for most of the projects I did, I'd be lucky if I could get 40% of the total cost in a bank loan. And so the Urban Redevelopment Authority, the city, matching facade grants, all of those things came into play over and over again. And I got pretty good at that. And what I didn't have was deep-pocketed investors who are generally, 3% of the population. And this is a statistic that plays itself out generally, older white men.
Yes.
Because I think investors, maybe at that time, and I'll be a little bit cynical, I really believe still today, are really not focused on impact. They're focused on a return.
That's
and
correct.
So real estate becomes a bit more of a commodity than a thing that can make a place better. And so I relied on a different type of investor. It was the city and the Urban Redevelopment Authority and my husband, who was pressed into service every now and then.
Right.
My architect, my contractors, who might get a little piece of equity instead of a fee. Those were my investors. So I built a portfolio of buildings that I'm actually very, very proud of. I did 5 or 6 projects in downtown Pittsburgh before anyone was doing work here. I did a couple of buildings in East Liberty before it gentrified, and that process horrified me.
I bet.
But they were all really interesting and unique buildings that needed someone to believe that a long-term hold was worth it.
Yeah.
That, you know, this is not, we're a bit of a Sesame Street society, right? We want instant gratification.
Right.
And that's not possible in places like that. You have to wait and be patient and nurture it and understand that you're building something in the long term. And then, you know, that was the path. And along the way, you know, because I could never get real estate agents to find me tenants, I actually built my own marketing team, my own management company. We did everything ourselves.
Wow, fabulous.
We really had to do everything ourselves because there was no other way to do it in a very lean manner.
And I think you mentioned once in one article I read that it was only 2% of women get funded by venture capitalists. It was sort of
that's today, and that hasn't really changed a lot. So I suppose that was part of the story early on for me, but I didn't really realize it.
Right.
I didn't realize what I was up against. Maybe not, but I didn't realize it was really that bad. For a long time, I knew I was the only female real estate developer in commercial real estate in Pittsburgh, which is an astounding thing to say. But that's what it was like. And so CityLab, little nonprofit that I launched before CityLab, big nonprofit emerged.
Okay, got it.
CityLab Pittsburgh, we did – you know, I launched that out of frustration with people seeing the possibilities. And so we did a few things. We held an event series with people on, you know, who are doing interesting things, pushing the envelopes. I created this, I did a bunch of projects in a neighborhood that was a really forgotten neighborhood, including Pittsburgh's first tiny house.
Is this the Garfield area, the project?
Garfield area. Yeah, and my purpose there was really to show people, you know, Garfield's unusual in that has, I don't know, 40% of its lots were vacant at the time, and they were really tiny. And so this was a tiny lot that didn't fit any zoning requirement. I mean, you literally could build like 10 square feet if you followed all the side setbacks and rear setbacks. And so I went through a very complicated process to be able to build a 230 square foot tiny house, the point of which was to show people what was possible and that they didn't have to really follow the norm to make something happen. So, and we also launched Pop City, which has now disappeared, but Next City followed. So all of that was kind of an interesting divergence.
And that was an e-magazine. That was the early, around 2006, five, and then went on over to another iteration there.
Right.
It just feels
so
such an ascent here, and you're rising in your craft and developing all these things and birthing these new ways of thinking.
What about the I'm a crazy person,
right? But incredible endurance and good crazy.
Endurance is my middle name.
That's it. Feels like it. What new things came to light? Like, who were your mentors, coaches, teachers, if anyone, and what was revealed through that?
Honestly, I've never really. I'm a bit of a loner.
Yeah.
I'm a bit of an introvert. So I have to say. Yes. Probably my husband more than anyone, who is even more of an introvert and really doesn't like change, egged me on to do these things, which is an odd thing to say, but he was always extremely supportive and interested in what I was doing. But
wonderful.
The architects I worked with were fabulous. Dutch McDonald, who was one of the principal, is actually also now a partner in my current company, Small Change. So there have been enduring relationships where leaned on people like that, Dutch being, I think, one of the primary people, and a few others. But on the whole, I think I'm a, how can I say this? This is a good thing and a bad thing. I'm not sure I think like other people, and this confuses me from time to time.
Yeah.
Because, like, I sort of believe people behave a certain way and then they don't.
Right.
So, yeah. But on the other hand, it set me on a path to try things on my own. I'm a maker. I like starting things and I think I'm pretty good at problem solving. So that's really who I am. But I think there was, so that was like the one part of my journey. And the second part of my journey started at the end of 2000s when literally my investors all disappeared.
Right.
And there had been a couple of things that happened through that decade that made it impossible for me to continue doing real estate projects. And at that point, I'd done five projects in downtown Pittsburgh. The largest one, a 70,000 square foot building, a conversion from a warehouse. A couple in East Liberty, one in North Oakland, another one in the Strip District, a very nice portfolio of interesting buildings, all supported by that funky group of partners I had, the URA, the city, one way or another, all of them had that type of support, historic tax credits, like local banks. So during that period, I think we saw a lot of bank consolidation. And at one point, we had over 15,000 banks in the country, and now there are less than 5,000.
Less than five.
And I really felt like community banking was dying. That was the first thing that happened. The second thing is that the Bush administration cut back on community development block grants. And that that was the money that trickled down, or, you know, came in fairly substantial amounts to the Urban Redevelopment Authority, who were really my primary partner. And they started saying to me, we have lost huge amounts of funding. We can't, we don't know who to invest in. We just don't have the money. And so they were, that partnership was gone. Okay. And they usually brought banks to the table as well. All of that kind of disappeared as they had to reinvent themselves. So let me see.
And what year was the major sort of catalyst of this decline?
It was kind of gradual.
Gradual.
It got harder and harder by the mid-2000s. And then, of course, the whole bank meltdown put the icing on the cake, because now developers need to come up with much more equity. Equity requirements increased. The whole thing just became impossible. And we'd also thought that over time – the market would improve here, but it was, and that the market would improve sufficiently to increase the return compared to the construction costs. But that really didn't happen in those years, because there were a couple of issues that really increased construction costs, like China sucking all of the metal out of the country. You know, so there were these odd moments that really defeated all of those ideas. So I found myself in the early teens realizing that I was not going to be able to do projects in the way that I was doing them. And I set about shutting down my company, made sure everyone had a job, spent a couple of years just shoring up my portfolio with a clear idea that I was going to put it in someone else's hands to manage, and then I was going to look for the next thing. In the mid-2000s, someone came to me who was in the construction company and also had securities experience, was securities law, and told me about this new law, the Jobs Act of 2012, that was essentially democratizing investment, and said, I think there might be a play here for real estate. And I couldn't shake that idea. It was fascinating to me, because what I'd learned in Pittsburgh was there is a crowd. Like, my neighbors used to band together to buy a building to stop it getting into the wrong hands. That was crowdfunding before crowdfunding.
Yes.
So I really thought, and every city I'd ever been to in like that, in the Rust Belt or smaller towns, people have so much pride for the places they live in, and they really want to be part of making it better. And so I started thinking of this in terms, well, if I had had those people as my investors, maybe I would still be in business. And that was really the genesis of Small Change, which is a real estate crowdfunding platform built on those security rules that were first regulated in 2012, but weren't actually implemented until 2016. So smallchange.co is a real estate crowdfunding platform where anyone over 18 and over can invest, and where developers can raise money from the crowd, from their crowd, and hopefully from our crowd too, but often from their crowd. Our constant is that in order for a developer to raise funds on our platform, they have to meet the criteria of our Small Change Index.
Of that 60%, that technology that you've created.
60% of that. Yeah, so it's a survey and questions that we ask that I should back up a little bit.
Please.
What I love about regulation crowdfunding is I didn't know what a securities was when I started. And so the SEC really approached this in the same way. If unsophisticated investors who don't know what securities are or have never invested before get an opportunity to invest, then those listing the investment opportunities ought to do it in plain English. And I love that about the rules. So no mention of sponsor unless you define it. No mention of waterfall in a real estate deal unless you define it. Like, you can't use words that people don't understand. You really have to explain it to them in plain English. And so I went looking for an ESG index early on that would work, and I really couldn't find one that I thought everyday people could understand, right? But I really thought that everyday people could understand, you know, that a street is better when there's no vacancy on it, that a building with a storefront that spills out on the street is livelier than a parking lot, or that a building which has green features is better than one that has none. So we built this index, and it's a survey that developers take, and they have to score at least 60% to be a fit. And for the most part, it's kept us honest. It's also branded us very well, because I don't remember the last time a developer approached us who did not fit our index.
That makes sense, yeah.
And there are many ways to fit, and we were purposefully ambiguous about that. So it could be a high-end luxury house that is a passive house on a city lot that was vacant for 30 years, that's manufactured housing. That's change, right?
Right.
Or it could be affordable housing that isn't thinking about green, but is programming financial literacy for its residents and helping them save money for down payment on a house.
A lot like the San Francisco project in the Tenderloin. I think that really speaks to that. It was incredible, as the housing rates are so over the top and sky high, nobody can get it at a place to live in San Francisco.
That one is a nonprofit who raised money to buy and convert a market rate 41 unit building into a cooperative owned by its BIPOC residents, which is pretty remarkable story.
And then they can pass that on in a legacy to their family.
That's like at the really high end of doing good.
That is a very much so.
That's probably like 100%.
Yes.
And some of them are lesser, but you know, even the act of the fact that they're taking the step to crowdfund is important, because that gives everyone an opportunity. So that's like, you know, 100 hours a week for me now.
Yes. No, and I so love that when you go through this smallchange.co and you start to look at all these projects, and one of them, the corner store in, I think it was in Detroit.
Yes. And she just closed.
Did she?
Yeah. What was really heartbreaking about that is Brenda Devine, who's the developer, is a very experienced real estate person. She actually launched a real estate office for the university in Detroit and really funded significant developers for them. And yet she had so much trouble raising a small amount of money. She could not get a bank loan. And here's why. She is Black and she's a woman. And so the statistics this year for people don't track commercial real estate lending. They track redlining, which that's we all know that's going on.
Okay.
And they track the where funds are flowing from venture capital funds. And this year, 2% of venture capital funds have flowed to women-owned companies and 1.2% to minority-owned companies.
Yeah,
and now realize, of course, that is no different in real estate. I'm sure it's the same whether someone tracks it or not. And so, you know, to list on out, what we're really most proud of also is that we now have close to 60% of the developers on our site are minority and or women.
That's fantastic.
And in that industry, that's a huge number. And we just want to keep that going.
Yeah, bringing accessibility where there was no even entry into the doorway.
No access
at all.
Capital,
that's right. And I also loved even in the high end where you had a Berkshire project where it was sort of like this old Queen Hotel that was going to be lost, and now it's going to be able to be enjoyed many people.
Let me tell you a little background on that.
Innovation.
That looks like a very sexy, glamorous project. It's a conversion of one of the Massachusetts great estates into a Vibro estate that you can rent for your next family event, right?
Right.
And it's as cheap as the local Holiday Inn. But what's really interesting to me about that, which is, I think, harder for most people to grasp, that particular team has a lot of trouble finding bank loans because banks consider them rural. So their financial capital stack is usually a negotiated loan from the person they're purchasing from. And then crowdfunding is a really important part of the funds they need to raise. And they are sure to look to everyone in that town and give them an opportunity to invest in that building.
Wow.
So while the buildings themselves look expensive and ritzy, the story behind them is really the same. It's a difficult project to accomplish.
Right.
It's an important historic landmark. I mean, they're all so different. I think that I love that creativity.
Yeah, I can see that really speaks to you with the design motif in your life. And if we had to, I think we've kind of seen the pivot of you moving and sort of creating this idea of fintech and this smallchange.co. And what about a rollback? Let's say if you had the opportunity, what would you redo or do differently, if anything?
Oh. Well, I think this funding portal is a very difficult business. Imagine a startup business with a compliance overlay.
Right.
For a small company, that compliance overlay is all consuming.
Yeah. That would be have a whole team of legal, just the.
Well, you know. Yeah, but you can't afford that as a small
right.
business.
Right, really that's hard.
What would I do differently? You know, I've really enjoyed my life, my career. I'm not sure I'd do much differently. Small change has been much harder than I thought, but still satisfying. I don't know. I don't know what I'd do differently. Maybe
that's great.
Tell me. I really don't know. Probably lots of things along the way. I wish I had realized early on what I was up against. That, but I'm not sure it would have changed things. And maybe being blind to the fact that women don't get funding, at least not many of them, was better for me because it was not something else that I was worrying about, if that makes sense.
It makes total sense. And I think in one interview I heard from you, the idea of no, just sort of strengthening your resolve and moving you forward. Like there's no no.
There's Don't no tell no in me my no. life.
I love that. I think that really speaks to your power and ethos and commitment and
I think
fortitude.
If I decide to do something, I already am pretty clear in my head what I think I can accomplish.
Mm-hmm.
I think other people probably think through the ramifications maybe better than me.
Okay.
But I'm really driven by this need to do things that have some purpose and some positive results. I get a lot of joy from it. So it's not just because I want to do good, it's because it gives me satisfaction. So
that makes sense.
This is what motivates me. And I'm really not motivated by money. I feel uncomfortable around money.
Yeah.
And I think that's why I love Reg CF so much. I really wish, and this has been one of the hardest things, and maybe I wish I had realized this earlier, is that I started this when impact investing was on the rise, and I really believed that people understood and wanted to invest for impact. But I would say that I've become a cynic. I think that people say they want to invest for impact, but really, even people with a lot of money put very little money in impact.
Especially
they put first and foremost into making a return, and that greed just kind of baffles me. If you can get, I mean, we're actually getting pretty decent returns. If you look at all of the returns, all of the buildings that have gone full cycle on our site.
I saw that on your site. I saw that.
Including one that failed completely and didn't give any money back, and one that didn't proceed but just gave the money back with no return. The average returns have been around 12.5%, which is not shabby, okay?
No.
And I think it's going to get better. I'm disappointed at what it's going to take to convince people with money that this is a viable thing for them to invest in, that if they really want to make a difference, then it's got to be more than $500, but it's got to be $50,000 or something like that into a project that is meaningful. That's been perhaps the hardest, yes, hardest thing to do. And in fact, that's why I do these podcasts. Part of publishing a podcast every week for me has been to build credibility, yes, for myself and for the platform, for people to be able to listen to me and my convictions and how I view things, and to be able to go to the website and understand how we are parsing things and planning things and as a result, listing things. We're not allowed to curate, but we have a very clear path. So
no, it's a very clear message.
That's been the biggest disappointing, actually. People who have money, really enough money for their lifetimes, really have a hard time parting with it.
Yeah, and are these cities going to stay there in the manner that they are? You know, all these, you know, some of these beautiful pre-war and elegant buildings like in Pittsburgh of the Carnegie Mellon era are going to cease to exist. Because it's, yeah, if it's a bottom line, if it's supposed to be a parking lot or something like that.
Well, you know, we do have historic laws, so that's good. Mm-hmm.
That's
so
helpful.
That's very helpful.
Yeah.
That's very helpful. But, you know, neighborhoods that really, yeah, it's a short-term hole versus long-term hole that is really the confounding thing. If you really want to be part of building something for the future, you just have to be thinking 10 or 20 years in advance, not 2 years, you know, or 1 year. Like, when can I get my money back? Like, stay in and you'll get a lot of money back.
Get a lot more.
But if you really want it tomorrow, you won't, you know, because,
And I think that patience that, you know, that you have in this is part of the one of the tenets of essential qualities that you can bring forward to people, and as you motivate them in their investment journeys, and I love
so
that.
So the other thing that's really come to the forefront this year is that there's been a real shift in the way that people are thinking about projects. So we've had a couple of projects now that are heading towards community owned, and that's really exciting to me. And they're using the same. The same rules that everyone else uses, the security rules, to invest in a company that is primarily held by the owner of the company, and they're figuring out ways to shift ownership to the community. And that is super exciting as well, I think, that because it shouldn't just be people with money who are in it for the long term.
That's right.
It should be everyone who's in it for the long term haul.
And I think that there was something in Evanston, Illinois, where a African American woman was a beautiful project, where it was a wellness center, and you know
that's actually a live offering, so I can't talk about it now.
Okay.
But I urge you to go to
smallchange.co
and take a look at the Ox Evanston. What I can say is that it is supported by philanthropy. But its purpose is to turn the building over to the community 100% and have the community manage it. And that is like it's pretty, I'm not allowed to say amazing.
Right. Got it.
No curation here. But that's a first. We've had other projects on our site. Lunia Richardson, Chicago Trend, has been working on a big, hairy, audacious goal. He wants to buy 100 community shopping centers and literally put ownership in the hands of the communities. He's doing it a little bit differently, halfway there. Okay. So he did one offering on our site where they needed $650,000 in equity, and the sponsors, put half of that in, and then they raised the other half from the crowd. And in this instance, they gave 49% ownership to the crowd. I mean, that's
substantial.
Very generous and substantial. Yeah. And their goal was to get as many Black investors in that neighborhood as possible.
Fantastic.
And then other really great stories like maybe I shouldn't mention that one, but there was the retreat at Lake Noir, which is now closed.
Okay. I think I did see that.
he has a second one open, but the first one that was closed, he's a real estate educator. He has his own real estate school. He loves real estate. That's what he's built his life around since a very young age. Mm-hmm. And he's determined to teach his community about it. So in that first project, I think about 85% of the investors were Black.
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty powerful
statement.
Yeah.
Really remarkable.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think we really touched on that low moment where, you know, closing your business, the bank shut down, and then having to make sure everybody, all your people are taken care of and they've got their jobs and figuring, okay, what's the next big thing for me? But take us to the anvil. What would be an event or decision that forged you, a defining moment that shaped your destiny?
In the future or in the past?
Whichever comes to you.
Well, moving to Pittsburgh defined me in the past, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the future, I think if someone with very deep pockets saw the value of small change and helped us really grow it into a big platform, that would be a defining moment.
Yeah, because it is that type of idea that we all need. And your journey, what's most important to you now, even? What does the road ahead look like to you, and what's next?
I think it's really the same goal.
Yeah.
I mean, I would like to grow Small Change into a go-to platform for people to both invest and raise money for real estate that will make a difference in one way or another. I mean, that's really the goal. I would love to find partners to help us do that on a large scale. That's the next very difficult part of the journey. To that end, we have our own crowdfunding platform. To that end, we have our own crowdfunding campaign open on WeFunder. We're not allowed to host it ourselves.
Okay.
So it's wefunder.com/smallchange.
Okay.
And in that campaign, anyone who's 18 and over can invest. And we would love to have investors, big and small, join us. That would be really fantastic.
Excellent. And we'll make sure to drop all those in the liner notes of this show so that you can have full access on all the offerings here and the information. And we just so love the Rethink Real Estate for Good is the media platform that you can go to. On that is the podcast that you have weekly.
That is the podcast. Again, that's our media voice. And we do one podcast a week. And I only interview people who I consider instigators.
Yes.
Instigators in disrupting the real estate status quo.
Perfect.
And there's amazing people that I've interviewed, and I have learned so much.
That's so great.
Yeah. So it's really been a great journey. We also write blog posts as well. So post events, a whole variety of things there.
There's a lot of great information and very well written. I love the concise writing that you bring to it. And if we look at the slipstream of your life, kind of looking in the rearview mirror, Eve, what or any parting gems of advice would you like to leave for us today?
I mean, whether you're an extrovert or an introvert, I think you leave your mark on the world. And so I would hope that everyone thinks about that when they go about their business. Not everyone is as lucky as I've been to live a life really doing everything they want. I understand that. But there are so many ways that people can leave a good mark on the world instead of a bad one. And I would hope that everyone's thinking about that.
Thank you, Eve. And thank you so much for all your beautiful work in the world and making cities better and giving us hope for change. Thank you so much for coming to Intrinsic Drive.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for being with us. We appreciate you opting in, subscribing, and reviewing us, for thumbing us up and following us on socials, liking us. We like you. Drop us a note. Tell us what stories move you. For books, videos, resources, and more information, visit us at whartonhealth.com/shopwhartonhealth. And be sure to join us for the next episode of Intrinsic Drive.